You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 20th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jonathan Daniel Wells talking about Northerners' complicity in the maintenance of the slave trade. Meanwhile, Netanyahu has pushed back against Biden's delayed call for a ceasefire as the death tolls in Palestine continue to skyrocket. Bibi says he'll, quote, continue this operation until its aim is met. By its aim, he means his political ambitions. Bernie Sanders is set to back Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's bill, attempting to block Biden's arms sale to Israel with a partner bill in the Senate. Senators will have to go on record about their stance here. Meanwhile, the ripple effects of Johnson & Johnson's contaminated vaccine batch are still being felt. The CEO acknowledged mold and unsanitary conditions at their Baltimore plant and said over 100 million doses are on hold. In Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott signs the equivalent of an abortion ban into law, banning the procedure after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Newsflash, by the way, a woman doesn't take notice about a missed period until at least a week after. This gives her 1 week to schedule the procedure, so this is a ban. Clearly unconstitutional, but still scary with the Supreme Court that we've got. Bank lobbyists are expressing frustration over Biden's $4 billion debt relief plan for black farmers, frustrated that they won't be able to maximize profits after decades of discriminatory loan practices. My heart just bleeds for them. Lula da Silva officially confirms he's running against Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro in 2022. What a comeback. And lastly, hundreds of corpses are being found throughout India, scattered in rivers and rural areas, adding to speculation that India's right-wing leader, Narendra Modi, is covering up the true COVID death totals, even as the country set a record for deaths on Wednesday. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out today, but he has pre-recorded an interview with Jonathan Daniel Wells. It's a great interview. Can't wait for you guys to hear it. But first, let's start off with, and I'm sorry to do this to the audience, Ted Cruz. So Senator Ted Cruz went on Sean Hannity's program last night, accusing Joe Biden of sabotaging Benjamin Netanyahu's state-sponsored terrorism, the murder of Palestinians indiscriminately, shooting into refugee camps, damaging their COVID testing facilities, damaging all of their infrastructure, and they don't have the funds to rebuild it. I mean, all of that. But let's not get facts get in the way of Ted Cruz's talking points here. Here he is on Fox News last night.
9 months ago, in the Middle East, we had peace flowering everywhere. We had the Abraham Accords. I was at the White House for the signing of the Abraham Accords. Incredible victories that President Trump had won by standing strongly and unequivocally with Israel. Joe Biden came in, and in just 4 months, he's frittered all of that away. He's undermined Israel and Prime Minister Netanyahu. He sent over $100 million to the Palestinian Authority, with the PA, which is in bed with Hamas. Hamas, the terrorists that are firing those rockets you're showing right now, they fired over 4,000 rockets into Israel. And every one of those rockets might as well have Joe Biden's name written on the side of it, because it is his weakness, his appeasement, his moral relativism and ambiguity, his lack a backbone to stand up and stand with Israel that is causing this war in the Middle East. Let me tell you what, Sean, what he ought to do. He ought to stand up and say, rather than lecturing Netanyahu, rather than being arrogant and attacking our friends, he ought to say, America stands unequivocally with Israel, period, the end. The Hamas terrorists need to stop right now. Israel has an absolute right to defend itself. If Hamas terrorists attack Israel, they will be dealt with and they will be killed. And he needs to right now replenish Israel's Iron Dome missiles. They are firing missiles to intercept these Hamas rockets. They fired thousands of Iron Dome missiles. But you know, instead, Joe Biden is appeasing AOC and Tlaib and the radical left.
Okay, so this is one of those instances in which Ted Cruz is not going to be deterred by the facts on the ground. He kind of stopped himself there when he said what Biden needs to do is he needs to replenish the Iron Dome. Biden is trying right now to sell over $700 million in arms to Israel currently. He's not doing that to Palestine. No, no, no. So what he referenced, that $100 million figure that the administration is sending to Palestine, that was aid that Trump had cut off to Palestine. Biden reinstated that aid. And now he's sending $10 million for housing and for reconciliation projects with Israel. That is not the same as the over $700 million in arms that Biden is trying to send right now, and Bernie Sanders and AOC are trying to block it in the House and in the Senate. He conveniently leaves that out. And you don't really need to take my word for it, right? Here is Benjamin Netanyahu himself thanking Joe Biden for his support.
אני בא עכשיו מהבור בקריה, נחמה למבצעים של צהל. זה מרשים ביותר. כל יום שעובר, אנחנו פוגעים בעוד יכולות של ארגוני הטרור. מסכלים עוד מפקדים בכירים, מפילים עוד מגדלי טרור, פוגעים בעוד מצבורי נשק. כפי שאמרתי היום לשגרירים שנאספו כאן, זו הזכות הטבעית של ישראל. אני הערכתי מאוד את התמיכה של הממשלות האלה, ואני מעריך במיוחד את התמיכה של נשיא ארצות הברית, ידידנו ג'ו ביידן, בזכות ההגנה העצמית של מדינת ישראל. אני נחוש להמשיך במבצע הזה עד שיושג היעד שלו להחזיר את השקט והביטחון לכם, אזרחי ישראל.
Until the operation is achieved. So he thanks Joe Biden there. Why is Ted Cruz the spokesperson for Israel in this case? Pretty sure that the right-wing leader of Israel has a little bit more standing to comment on this issue. Joe Biden has been disastrous in his handling of this current conflict. He has given full rein to Israel to drop as many bombs as they want. And it's getting so old at this point, these talking points don't work. Claiming that Hamas started the conflict, that is unequivocally false. The Israeli government began displacing Palestinians in East Jerusalem, and then when that didn't work to spark violence to help Netanyahu's efforts at forming a governing coalition in the upcoming election, then they stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque. I always say it closer to Alaska, and I tried to stop myself there, and brutalized worshipers during a holy celebration multiple times. Wow, then there's retaliation. What do you know? But the retaliation, that's the terror. Those are the terrorists, because they don't have the power and the money to get out of, and the whiteness often, and the backing by the United States, to get out of being called terrorists, because they're not an official state. They've been denied statehood repeatedly by the United States, by Israel, by their influence. And so I guess when you're an official state, you are able to kind of squirm out of being called terrorists. But what Israel is doing on a exponentially larger level is terrorism in and of itself, is it not? They're targeting civilians. They're targeting healthcare infrastructure. They're targeting refugee camps. If you heard Hamas was doing that, Ted Cruz, you know you'd call it terrorism.
They're bombing the roads to hospitals and then bombing the hospitals.
Yeah, yes, they're bombing hospitals. If that doesn't count as terrorism, and by the way, as we've mentioned multiple times on this program, Israel has the ability to target their bombs, and Hamas's / Palestine's much weaker bombs, they go wherever they land. There's no ability for them to target where they're going to land end up. And that's evidenced by the fact that, you know, essentially, the Israeli bombs have been so much more targeted and very specific. The fact that they went after multiple Palestinian news sources, and then also international ones, including Al Jazeera and the AP, are indicative of that.
Well, so, it says everything that the metric Ted Cruz uses is number of rockets fired and not Israeli casualties, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the entire point of the obfuscation. And there's nobody who can get himself more worked up around a false narrative than Ted Cruz. His feigned outrage there, it was so transparent that he just essentially was trying. He started with his conclusion. Oh, Biden's weak on Israel. And then he worked backwards from it. And you can kind of see him trying to play act in that situation, or LARP, or whatever the case may be. So,
A little presidential too, or, you know, his perception of challenging Biden in a presidential executive type tone.
Please don't put that thought in my head, Brendan. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Sam will be interviewing, I'm so sorry, I have it in my notes, I am scrolling up, Jonathan Daniel Wells, and we will be right back with that interview.
We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the program Jonathan David Wells. He is a professor of history at the University of Michigan and the author of The Kidnapping Club, Wall Street, Slavery, and the Resistance on the Eve of the Civil War. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, so let's start. What I find fascinating about this story, in addition just sort of the history being fascinating, is... This is a story of race, and it's a story of class, and it is a story also of almost like a pincer move in terms of class on these free black kids, sometimes women, men, where the the context is in many ways set by Wall Street, and some of the pressure and animosity is coming from the sort of the pitting of black freed people and white working class, I guess maybe early immigrants as well. So let's start, though, because your story starts in the mid to earlier 1800s. In many respects, but give us the context of the relationship between New York and Wall Street in particular, and the in the South. And obviously this has to do with, and, you know, it's been a couple of years, but, you know, things like King Cotton, and one being the sort of the natural resource and the other being the financing of this.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In fact, New York today, as we all know, is this amazing place, right? It's a pluralistic, you know, politically progressive city. It's very lively. It's got so much to offer in terms of culture. But unfortunately, the history of New York City harbors a much darker, a much bleaker past. And that's kind of what I wanted to write about in the book. And you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the reasons why New York turns out to be so strongly pro-South and even to some degree pro-slavery is because of Wall Street's connections to the cotton trade in the South, which, of course, is all being harvested on the backs of enslaved people. So all that cotton that needs to be baled up as raw materials needs to make its way through the ports of the American South and then ultimately to the factories in the United Kingdom or in the New England states. And they have to be then turned into finished products, right? All the nice fine linens and clothing and curtains that people will enjoy in their fine homes. So it's New York financiers that help to facilitate the movement of raw materials, the cotton, to the places where they'll be turned into finished products. So Wall Street is not the behemoth yet in this period of American history that we come to know today. It's on its way to becoming sort of, you know, the sort of massive financial center that it is today. But nonetheless, I think it's a really good sort of shorthand for what New York City, particularly Lower Manhattan, is becoming, you know, in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, those decades right before the Civil War. So much of the wealth and much of the power of New York City as it grows into a world financial capital is unfortunately built on the backs of enslaved labor in the South.
So it's basically mercantile and financial forces. And that encompasses, I got to imagine, right now we should say, slavery is outlawed in New York in 1827, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, how much of the economy in the establishment of, like, you know, what made up the politics at that time were, you know, reliant, like you say, in Southern New York? I mean, maybe you should just give us also like a broader picture of like what New York was like at that point. Like, I think at that point, there's still like fields by the time you get up until like the I don't know, the 70s or, you know, up by Central Park. But mercantile, then that being, you know, everything that's involved with ships coming in to the harbor and everything associated with that and finance must have been fairly powerful. I mean, I can't, like, what else would there be at that time?
So that's absolutely right. We're talking about a city with hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, even by the time we get to this 1830s, 40s, and 50s. So, you know, it's not a little tiny town. It's well on its way to becoming the New York City that we know. And one of the things that makes the city so prosperous, as I mentioned, is in fact the cotton trade. But it's also because New York is very democratic. And I mean, you know, party Democratic Party. And as I'm sure your listeners know, that the political parties are fundamentally different in this period of American history than they are today. It's 180 degrees difference. So the party that's really the most intransigent, the most conservative and reactionary when it comes to race is the Democratic Party. And so, you know, if Donald Trump was alive in the 1840s and 50s, maybe he was, then, you know, he would have been a Democrat. And it's the Democratic Party that is so beholden to the South, not only because of the cotton trade, but because they want to keep this prosperous union together. And if your listeners will go back to, you know, maybe back in grade school, they'll remember that one of the features of the nation's founding document, the Constitution itself, has a feature called the Fugitive Slave Clause. And that meant that if you were somehow able to make it to freedom, if you were a person of color, an enslaved person in Georgia or Texas or the Carolinas, and you made it somehow to New York City, that didn't mean you were free, even though New York's state's laws, along with Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, say we are getting rid of slavery. In fact, the Constitution required that you would be returned to your quote-unquote master. And so, you know, the Democratic Party is so willing to sacrifice Black human beings, and as you mentioned, men, women, and children, on this altar of keeping the Union together. They want to make the White South happy. They want to prove, you know, that they're not radicals, that they're willing to abide by the Constitution. That's really, you know, what combines to make New York City really the most pro-slavery, pro-South city north of the Mason-Dixon line. And that's quite a statement, because these things are also going on in Boston and Philly. But New York is kind of unique in the extent to which the political system, the legal system, the economic system is all geared against the interests of Black New Yorkers.
All right. And that's the sort of the impetus we've described in terms of those who were financially invested in the success of the South and the maintenance of the Union. And then I would imagine too, at that time, on a local level, we are in an era where there's, you know, it's very much about like, how many votes can I get that, you know, that come off this boat tomorrow? And, you know, this is going to enhance my political power on a sort of on a local level. And those, you know, working class immigrants who may not be considered white in the way that they're considered white today, because they are from a different country, right? But there is still value in creating and some type of like resent for, you know, competition about, you know, who can get these low wage jobs. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We're talking about Irish immigrants here, coming in the 1840s and 1850s by the millions. And when they go to places like New York City, they need jobs, they need places to live. And here comes the Democratic Party with its power base in Tammany Hall in New York City. And the Tammany Hall machine, the political machine, was heavily dependent on Irish immigrant support. And they are absolutely concerned about competing for jobs in the warehouses of the city, jobs along the wharves of the Battery and the East River and the Hudson Rivers, you know, loading and unloading ships, you know, the real heavy duty work. They resent having to compete with Black laborers for those kinds of positions. And so the animosity, the level of hostility toward the city's Black population is really hard to fathom today. It's so extensive. And even though I don't really cover this in the book, there are other historians who have looked at the draft riots during the Civil War in 1863 in July. And that's when we see the Irish working class really going on a stampede day after day for almost an entire week against Black New Yorkers. So, you know, again, it's very different from the way we think of New York today. It's troubled and wrought by ethnic conflicts, racial tensions, class dissension. And on top of that, of course, are the political battles that are going on in the city for every level of office. So it's a place that far from, you know, sort of a place where Black people can feel at ease, or somehow, even if they were runaways, they can sort of take a deep breath. They're constantly looking over their shoulders for somebody who might be arresting them as a runaway. And for many of them, it really wasn't until they crossed the border into Canada, which was the real land of the free in this period of history, when they were finally out of the reach of the U.S. government.
I want to talk about how the Underground Railroad plays into this, actually. And in fact, on my way to work, very often I go by a place on Duffield Street in Brooklyn. I don't know if you came across this, that was, you know, I think there is some belief that it was part of the railroad. So let's talk about the kidnapping club. I mean, did they refer to themselves as the kidnapping club? I mean, when did this club begin? And we should say, when we're talking about, slavery is outlawed in 1827, which means that you have free Black folk there. Occasionally, or I don't know how you put into context how many Black folk were in the city who had escaped other places. So they would still be subject to the Fugitive Slave Clause, which then is subsequently outlawed repealed in 1850. Give us a sense of like the timing of all this and how everything sequences.
Yeah, sure. So the Fugitive Slave Clause is pretty clear in the Constitution. It says northern states, northern communities have to return people who are accused of being runaways. But it doesn't really provide any mechanism for doing that. There's no teeth in the law. And it's really the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 that reinforces the clause and says, you know, now we're going to have a system in place. We're going to have U.S. Marshals. We're going to have a bureaucracy to appease the white South so that we ensure that we can return as many runaways as is feasible.
And the idea, I should be clear, is to maintain. I mean, I presumably the clause itself, and then the sort of the mechanism that's set up in 1850, is at first is probably just sort of a way so that we can feel unity, right? Like we have a relationship that is different than if we were a different country. You don't need extradition papers. It is what it is, and then this as an attempt to sort of maintain this unity, we're even going to develop an apparatus.
That's right. a large, significant government apparatus to make the return to runaways all the easier. And this is where the kidnapping club comes in. So the name actually comes from a black abolitionist named David Ruggles, who is, in my mind, somebody really deserving of much more attention from modern day Americans than he is given. He is really the hero of the book that I've written. And he's the one that slaps this label on them, the New York Kidnapping Club. It's not really a social club. It's not a social organization, although, you know, Manhattan is still small enough that they all know each other. But instead, it's a group of police officers, judges, and slave catchers, U.S. Marshals. And together, they really do everything they can to make freedom precarious for Black people. And David Ruggles is one of these activists who is just so tireless and just so, you know, seemingly everywhere at once. And he's on the lookout for any signs of racial injustice, including times when the New York police officers so-called, you know, arrest somebody so-called for being a runaway. And they don't really care whether the person is a runaway or, you know, had been generations of freedom in their families. And so a couple of guys in particular, a guy named Tobias Boudinot and another guy named Daniel Nash, these are two police officers, and they would, you know, simply arrest somebody on the street and say, you know, I'm taking you before the recorder Riker, Richard Riker, who was kind of the city's judge.
Was Riker's Island named after him?
Just coincidence. No, yeah. But, you know, of course, it's a testament to the city's Dutch heritage, right? I mean,
right.
The Riker name. But it might as well have been for, you know, even if it's not factual. I mean, the truth is that this is a period in which Black lives are expendable. And Richard Riker, who is the city recorder, is unfortunately for the city's Black residents, the one who's charged with deciding officially whether Joe Smith is in fact somebody who ran away in 1832 from a Virginia plantation, or is Joe Williams, who has been born in New York City to free parents, you know, in 1820. So the bad news is that particularly at the height of the nefarious activities of the kidnapping club, particularly in the 1830s, they can sweep somebody off the streets of New York within hours, take them, you know, these individuals before Richard Riker. Riker declares that they're a runaway slave without caring very much whether they are, you know, really a runaway or not. And that person is taken away to Southern slavery before, you know, the family members even know they're missing. So it's a efficient, very cruel group of New York power brokers who are making life miserable for the 15 to 20,000 or so Black people who live in New York City in this period of American history.
And the mayor is at least providing some, you know, air cover, I guess, for this too on some level. You write, and the how much of this was just racism? How much of it was like sort of commodified at that point? And tell folks like what would happen? Like where do they drop them off? I mean, it like what like they just take them to a, I guess, like a slave brokerage house, essentially, because some of these people, they're obviously not slaves, so there's no plantation owner coming up and going, you know, that's my property. Walk us through the mechanics of this.
Well, believe it or not, there were many white slave owners who go to New York City, who go to Boston, who go to Philadelphia. They maybe catch word somehow that their so-called escaped property has made it to Philadelphia. And so they and maybe, you know, some other thugs that they hire, you know, search the city streets for these individuals. And it's remarkable how often, at least in their minds, that they find the person that they're looking for, despite, you know, the growing
size. But they're not really find. I mean, a big part of that is like that guy looks like he would be a good slave. That's my slave.
That's unfortunately, you know, we will never know, because you're absolutely right. They could make that claim, and there's very little in the law that is standing in the way until we get jury trials in New York State. And that begins to happen in the 1840s. And that's sort of what causes the kidnapping club's machinery to start grinding to a halt, because no longer can you just take somebody off the street, take them before the recorder Riker, and in 2 hours, they're on a boat, you know, with a slave catcher whose, you know, job it is, profession it is, to take people into slavery. Now you have to have a jury trial where you're allowed to present evidence. So that's part of the story of the unfolding of freedom and the decline of the kidnapping club. But, you know, it's just unbelievable how terrorized the Black communities were in New York City. And we're talking about, you know, people who had for generations established lively communities and neighborhoods in New York City, all the way back to the 17th century. There were very vibrant and vigorous and healthy Black families and Black neighborhoods. One of them was called Seneca Village, and it was wiped out to create Central Park in the 1850s, completely wiped off the map. And, you know, I think when I was writing this book, and I think maybe from the perspective of readers, they'll sympathize with this too, as bleak and as dark as the stories tend to be, you also have to admire and be inspired by, I think, you know, the fact that guys like David Ruggles were part of these vibrant Black communities and were literally risking their lives to promote racial justice. And you mentioned Brooklyn. You know, there are actually slaves being held in the heart of Brooklyn in the late 1830s.
I was going to say, so, tell that story about Ruggles. He goes across the river. Because he hears about a couple of slaves. I mean, so slavery is outlawed in 1827, but there's still a vibrant Black market, if you will, of slaves. But talk about what Ruggles did in that one occasion.
So Ruggles catches wind of the fact that there's a family in Brooklyn who is holding Black enslaved people at their house. And he was fearless, Ruggles. I mean, he was somebody who was just, you know, he wouldn't shy away from a fight. So he literally goes across the ferry. There's no bridge to Brooklyn at this point. So he goes across the ferry, finds the house in the heart of Brooklyn, and knocks on the door. And as it turns out, the Dodge family lives there. They were originally from Savannah, and they have taken three of their enslaved people to the heart of Brooklyn. And Ruggles says, you know, look, you can't do this. It looks like the guy, the father of the family, the patriarch is not there. So he has to deal with the woman of the household. And he sees down in the basement these three enslaved people. And he goes down to talk to them, you know, sort of brushes his way past the woman of the house down to the basement and says, you are free. You are not enslaved in the state of New York, in the city of Brooklyn. And, you know, he recounts all of this almost word for word in a newspaper that he publishes called The Mirror of Liberty. And this is what allows me and other historians to really tell these stories in such rich detail. You know, the fact that Ruggles records these encounters with such a striking degree of detail really allows us to sort of reinsert ourselves into that situation. So
the woman says something to the effect of like, oh, these slaves don't want to leave because they'll be disoriented without me. And one of the slaves said, we're disoriented because you're hitting us.
Yeah, she says something like to one of the enslaved young women, you know, you can't do without me. And the woman answers back, yeah, well, you hit me on the head enough times that, I get dizzy spells. And, you know, the woman of the house says to the enslaved people, in fact, isn't it true that you're actually free? You're not enslaved. And they answer, well, that's what you told us to tell anybody who asks, you know, like David Ruggles. So it's pretty clear what's going on.
From a legal perspective, if you're a slave and you, I mean, this is the sort of the weird dynamic, right? Because if they stay in Savannah and these slaves come up to New York, they can legally be sent back. But if the family takes them up to New York, then they become freed, right?
Isn't that ironic? Yeah. And it's only through the, if anybody notices, I mean, you know, there are many, many dozens of cases here, a lot of them involving David Ruggles, but God knows how many there were that we'll never know about. I mean, even a person like Ruggles, who was tirelessly patrolling the city, undoubtedly missed untold numbers of people who were ensnared in the web of the kidnapping club.
There's a quality that he reminds me of there was a guy, I don't know what happened to him. He may still be around, but who was in New York. I think he was in New York, who was basically would just roam the streets with a phone camera when they became sort of first ubiquitous and would capture these incidences of police abuse. I want to talk a little bit about the parallels between what was happening with the kidnapping club and ICE on some level over the past couple of years in a moment, but tell us the story of Henry Scott. I mean, one of the things that I think that your book does, in part because Ruggles provided at least part of your primary source material, is it's like a modern day account. I mean, it is quite an ethnography, obviously, but you get a real sense of like people's lives and the fears. Tell us about Henry Scott.
So that's one of the more troubling chapters of the book, one of the more difficult instances. So Henry Scott is 7 years old. And according to a white slave owner from North Carolina, Henry Scott had been taken by his father, who was also an enslaved man, and they left a Virginia plantation and made it to freedom in New York City. And so Henry Scott is at his school desk one Saturday at the African Free School, which were the primary ways that, you know, Black children were educated in this period. And as he's sitting, the door to the classroom bursts open, and there are two white men standing in the doorway. One of them is a sheriff, and the other is a white slave owner from North Carolina, and they claim that Henry and his father are, in fact, runaway slaves. And you can just imagine the pandemonium that would have broken out in the classroom of grade school children. I mean, they're crying, they're hiding under their desks, they run out the door and the windows. It's really heartbreaking, and it's a very scarring incident on the generation of Black New Yorkers living there at the time. And one of the more touching revelations, there are children in the African Free Schools who learn about this case, and they gather pennies, you know, from their parents or grandparents or around the house. And for example, the girls in one of the African Free Schools, they gather together $2 worth of pennies. And the goal is to help contribute to little Henry Scott's legal defense, because that's what he needs now after being accused of running away. Unfortunately for both Henry Scott and his father, they are brought before Richard Riker, sort of the apex at the top of the kidnapping club. And once again, he doesn't really care that much whether they are in fact free or enslaved. They sit in prison. And Riker actually allows the white slave owner to go back to North Carolina to gather more evidence to prove that these people are enslaved, including Henry Scott. And ultimately, it seems that the community came together and purchased the freedom of Henry Scott and his father. But as I said, I mean, this was a scarring incident on the city. And by the way, you know, this did happen sometimes, that the Black community or even white abolitionists, you know, there were white anti-slavery activists too, and they would raise money to purchase the freedom. So basically they're paying off the master to say, okay, this person is free now. But you can imagine that's kind of complicated morally, right? Because not only are you handing a substantial amount of money over to a slave owner, but you're also in some way legitimizing the system, you know, through a business transaction. But, you know, there were many anti-slavery activists, including Black activists, who said, yes, you know, by purchasing freedom for somebody, in a way, we're conducting business with a slave owner. But this is what we're forced to do in these kind of circumstances. So there's a lot of other examples, but Henry Scott's story is one of the most painful.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, that's at the top of the list. Is there any other that stands out for you that is, I think, indicative that you think is indicative of that time and any of the sort of the unique dynamics that are happening there?
Yeah, there are so many that exhibit just a startling amount of callousness. But there's one young woman. Her name is Hester Carr. And she is, in fact, born free. She's born free to free parents. She works for a doctor in New York. It's possible that she had some kind of cognitive disability of some kind. But she is demonstrably free. She has, a very clear heritage that indicates her free status. And yet she is tricked by a woman who says, well, if you come down to Virginia with me, I'll pay you much more than this doctor in New York is paying you to keep our house. And she goes with the woman willingly. And then as soon as she gets off the train in Virginia, the white woman who is her traveling companion has her locked in jail and then sells her as a slave. Before she can even be removed from jail, Hester Carr dies in prison at the age of, I think, 22. But it just shows you, just the tremendous inhumanity that is existing here. And by the way, I need to mention, I think, it's not a matter of pointing to New York or Brooklyn and saying, well, look, aren't these northern cities just as evil as what's going on in the American South, right? It's just not an attempt to in any way reduce the horrors of American slavery in the South, the crimes of generations of white slave owners that they inflicted on humanity. But it is to say that here we are in New York City, America's great capitalist metropolis, booming example of a financial world center. And right here in the heart of Manhattan, we see slavery. We see the cheapening and expendability of Black lives. And it just reminds us how much of the nation's whole history is bound up with this past.
I mean, I'm also struck, too, that the relationship between we're here in this major capitalist center that is developed and has finance and whatnot. And this is happening. It's not, in many respects, it's not despite the fact that we're in a capitalist center that this is happening. It is in many respects a function of that, right? I mean, all of these stories involve the commodification of these human beings. There is a definitive, and even in the context that makes it that sort of like creates the ambiance in which this can happen, it's all driven in some respects by the our economic system.
Absolutely, and it's part of the reason why New Yorkers look the other way, not just the powerful in the police departments or people in the judiciary or people in the, on Wall Street, whether they're bankers or financiers or merchants or insurance agents, they're all willing to look the other way because they know exactly how the city is growing, both in terms of its wealth and its power. And one of the things I think is really interesting here is sort of the evolution of the average sort of white New Yorker on this story, because I say white New Yorker because Black New Yorkers were all already very clearly aware of right. How evil slavery was. And the fact that many white New Yorkers who thought maybe slavery was not really their concern. You know, slavery is a Southern problem. I'm in New York. What do I have to do with it? I could care less. You know, when people are being seized on the streets of the city, possibly people who were born free and may have lived in the city for 30 or 40 years, well, you know, it's much harder to make this claim that slavery is merely a Southern phenomenon, without which, you know, we New Yorkers have little to do. So, you know, there is a sort of coming abolitionist sort of anti-slavery sentiment. And that's part of the story, too, that, you know, as callous and as cruel as the city could be, increasing numbers of white New Yorkers are coming to see not only that the Fugitive Slave Clause in the Constitution and the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 are fundamentally immoral, but maybe there's something wrong with the union itself. And we sometimes, I think, really think about the coming of the Civil War as, okay, well, this is a Southern story, right? Because Southerners are the ones who secede. They're the ones who are so beholden to slavery. But we forget sometimes that Northerners could have said, you know, fine, leave the Union. Don't let the door hit you in the rear end on the way out. But they didn't. Northerners, many of them formerly moderate, sort of fence-sitting, uncaring white Northerners, also had to come to the conclusion that there was something wrong with the Union. And they also had to sort of be willing to lay a great deal of money and a great deal of lives on the line.
So lastly, how does this apparatus end in New York? I mean, I guess really, I imagine the Civil War makes it finalize it. But was it, I guess, like, you know, absent the Civil War, does this end on its own accord? Does New York rise up and say, like, we're just not going to, I don't know, is it like the equivalent of, like, you know what, we're not signing that agreement. Our sheriff is not signing the agreement with ICE, and we, I don't care what the feds say.
Yeah, if only that were the case. So it's really important and a good question. Here's the irony. So the kidnapping club that I write about is on decline by the 1840s, in part because, as I mentioned before, the institution now jury trials. So it makes it harder just to, you know, take somebody and immediately whisk them away. But right at the time that the kidnapping club is declining, we see a dramatic rise. This is not something we got a chance to talk about, but it's in the book, and readers can check it out. The fact that New York City is a port in the transatlantic slave trade that had been done away with, made illegal by Congress way early in the 1800s. And here we are in the 1840s, and even on the cusp of the Civil War in the 1850s and in 1860 and 61, where New York is one of the fundamental cities, along with Havana, Cuba, engaged in this horrific West African transatlantic slave trade. So I wish it were a story of New Yorkers sort of coming to, you know, realize the immorality and injustice of the system as a whole. Unfortunately, it's something that continues to the Civil War and beyond. And that's kind of what I'm working on in my next book. And I'll just finish by saying, you know, there's a newspaper that is published every week in New York City during the Civil War and during the period after the war. And here's the title of it. It's called the New York Weekly Caucasian. It's a white supremacist newspaper, and it's spread all across the country, and it comes right from the heart of New York. So
I mean,
it doesn't get any better, unfortunately, in many ways.
Well, it's not. I mean, you know, I guess 40 years later, there's a massive, you know, Madison Square Gardens filled with KKK members, 20 or 30,000, I think, were there. I mean, it's not. Jonathan David Wells, professor of history, University of Michigan. The book is The Kidnapping Club, Wall Street Slavery and Resistance on the Eve of the Civil War. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
excellent interview there that Sam did. I always appreciate some historical context and some, I guess, just clarification on our history, because so much of it is papered over. Before we go, I wanted to talk about this clip with Tim Ryan. So Tim Ryan is running for the Senate. He is currently a member of the House of Representatives, and he had a very fiery speech on the House floor about the many Republican leaders who have decided that they aren't interested in a bipartisan commission to find out really what happened during the January 6th insurrection. Here is Tim Ryan on the House floor.
I want to thank the gentleman from New York and the other Republicans who are supporting this and thank them for their bipartisanship. To the other 90% of our friends on the other side of the aisle, holy cow, incoherence. No idea what you're talking about. Benghazi, you guys chased the former Secretary of State all over the country, spent millions of dollars. We have people scaling the Capitol, hitting the Capitol Police with lead pipes across the head, and we can't get bipartisanship. What else has to happen in this country? Cops. This is a slap in the face to every rank and file cop in the United States. If we're going to take on China, if we're going to rebuild the country, if we're going to reverse climate change, we need two political parties in this country that are both living in reality, and you ain't one of them. I yield back the balance.
That was a political ad. Or something that it might actually not be allowed. You might not be able to use footage. I'm not exactly sure of the rules. Does that apply to House floor speeches?
I'm not sure of that.
Yeah, well, that's why, I mean, I think the Kristen Sinema thumbs down. There was some technicality where they weren't going to be able to use that footage. But regardless, you know, the goal isn't bipartisanship, Tim Ryan. I understand his outrage about this. I mean, the fact that Republicans, many of whom would have been targeted by these insurrectionists, these QAnon folks, many who rioted and who stormed the Capitol, they are bowing down to their daddy, Donald Trump, and they are essentially saying, well, my political fate and my career is in the hands of these Trumpies and these MAGA folks, so I'm not going to do anything to anger them by supporting this commission, and who cares if my life was at risk? I'm going to get beyond that. I'm going to stuff that down real low.
I mean, I don't think they even feel like they're... like, I think this is bigger than Trump. I think this is just all these Republicans are anti-majoritarian, they're anti-democratic, and this is... this isn't a security issue. The problem is January 6th was not a security problem. It was a political problem. I'm sorry, but like when you have a party saying an election was stolen in any country, you can expect some part of the population to react pretty aggressively toward that. And I think that's frankly justifiable. The problem is you have a party predicated on lying about it, and they are still predicated on lying about it. So of course they're not going to want to investigate January 6th, because the real thing that needs investigating about January 6th is a party predicated about lying on the election.
And yes.
And they cannot go past that.
Well, they also don't want to set a precedent in this instance, because they can't acknowledge that they lied about the results of the election, because they're going to do it again. They are going to do it again. Stop the Steal has been in the works in the Roger Stone pipeline for decades at this point. This was part of the effort to stop the recount in 2000. Roger Stone also behind that, much of the same people who are involved in this. This is a part of the playbook, so they have to kind of deny the results of it in order to use that same playbook again, right? But back to Tim Ryan, he's in the right, but the goal is not bipartisanship. The fact that you're focusing on bipartisanship is frustrating in and of itself, and is indicative of the kind of credence that you shouldn't be giving to the GOP, because this is always who they've been. But really, I would be more annoyed if I wasn't aware that this was being used literally just for his Senate campaign. The fact that he shoehorned China in the middle of there, come on, dude. I mean, the grandstanding, I get it's going to work. It was seemingly targeted to Ohio. But for me, it was a bit cringe-inducing. However, it is outrageous, and
It undercuts the argument about how outrageous the Republican Party is, because we're still entertaining it, that we're still outraged about it. We should move beyond that understanding, because it's the same thing with, like, how about these fossil fuel supported scientists? Like, why won't you guys get it about climate change? They are fundamentally, like, their existence is about not getting that. So of course they're going to be anti-democratic. So you need to move on and, like,
codependence.
Yeah, convey reality instead of your exasperation and, you know, outrage, which is frankly, like, that's cheap at this point.
We are unfortunately out of time. Thank you guys so much for tuning in on the Peacock app. We will see you tomorrow. Except for the rest of us, we'll be seeing you now. We will be joined by old Matt. But first, I want to ask everybody, become a Majority Report member. If you like this show, if you care about this show, if you care about the future of this show, we could definitely use your support. And please just go to majority.fm. You get the fun half and you get the free show without ads. And yeah, it's just a great way and a cheap way to support the show. So if you guys have the ability, please do that. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning and such?
Yeah, looking forward tomorrow or tonight on Left Reckoning 8 Eastern. We're having Brandon Sutton on. We're going to talk about masks. I'm interested in masks sort of as a culture war topic. And how, like, who really needs that? I think it's kind of clear which side really wants the mask issue to be one that drives people apart. But and then we're going to talk about Breyer and why he needs to retire. And I just realized his name rhymes with that. So retire Breyer.
Breyer. Hashtag retire Breyer.
That's tonight. Patreon.com/leftreckoning to access David Griscom and I in the post game. We are, I think, 2 patrons shy of 800. So if you would like to be the 800th, you might have a chance for that tonight. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. Subscribe to the YouTube channel as well. And we don't have Matt Binder yet. We'll have to do Binder plugs at the end, maybe.
He must be staying away because he knows that I'm going to be controlling the phones today.
Wow.
Yeah, right? I'm in Sam's seat, so I got the phone power. Check out Nomi's show, the Nomi Keys show, at 3 p.m. today, Tuesday through Friday. But she also has a guest host on Mondays. And yeah, should we just head into the fun half and hopefully Binder shows his beautiful face? All right, guys. Wait, what's the number? 646-257-3920. Goddamn, I got it. See you in the fun half.
Woo. RM for it. All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt!
Can we bring back DJ Danner Key's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them.
What?
you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black.
Come on.
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.